The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Andrea, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you will be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Chelsea F.
Hi, Chelsea Alcoholic. So first, I'd like to thank Marty for asking me to speak. It's always an honor to participate in my sobriety, especially at this meeting. And I'll quickly qualify. My sobriety date is October 2nd, 2007. My sponsor is Linda L., and my home group is the Pacific Group. So I'll quickly tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Hopefully focusing on what it's like now, because it's crazy right now in life. But I am an alcoholic through and through. My alcoholism has manifested in many different ways throughout my life and even throughout my sobriety. So when I was really little, it was mostly a lot of fear. I felt like just a very shy, weird kid. I was pretty shy and weird. I still am. I now know that part of that is my alcoholism. Part of that's just me. But it also manifested into depression. I thought that there was, you know, I had like a mental disorder at one point. I just became very depressed. And, you know, even now, if I'm not working a good enough program, I can just be a nasty nagging wife. So working on always working good programs, so I'm not like that. But just like how my alcoholism has manifested, the way I treat my alcoholism has also changed quite a bit. So outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, the best cure for my alcoholism or the best treatment is alcohol. I love alcohol. I loved alcohol. I love the effect produced by alcohol. And for me, I definitely noticed a shift in my perception of myself and the world around me when I took a drink of alcohol. I remember my very first drink very vividly. I remember a lot of different drinks very vividly. And any time I drank, from my first to my last, it was just a complete, you know, it got rid of all that shyness, all that fear. I didn't care what you thought about me. I didn't care what I thought about you. It was just pretty magical. If I still could drink, then I would, because it's that quick fix that to get rid of, you know, just pretty much everything in my head and to quiet everything that's going on up here. So for my first drink, all throughout high school, you know, my disease is progressive as all of ours is. And my drinking also progressed. It took a lot more drinks, a lot more outside issues to get that same fix that I was looking for. And what ultimately happened, I came out to LA to go to school. My sophomore year of college, at that point, I had tried a lot of different things to, you know, get that same effect that alcohol used to give me. I tried therapy, a lot of outside substances. I became a blackout drinker, so I was blacking out almost every time I drank. A lot of scary situations, not knowing what happened the night before. And I began to just really get sick of my drinking. And I tried a lot of the things that the Big Book talks about. I tried limiting the amount of drinks. I tried drinking beer only, drinking on certain nights. And my last night of drinking, I had come off a stint at a sorority party where I had tried not to drink for 24 hours. And at this point, I was kind of just a garbage can putting pretty much any substance inside that would try to get that same release that I felt earlier on in my drinking career. And, you know, 24 hours sober was pretty painful. So I think I kind of rebelled, quickly blacked out. I don't remember a lot of that night, but the next morning woke up back at home in San Diego. No idea what had happened the night before. Still healing like a broken ankle. I had, you know, two black eyes. Like at this point I had stitches in my chin. I didn't know how that happened. And my parents sentenced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mom and dad knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was because my grandpa and grandma were members of Alcoholics Anonymous and actually old time members of this group, Byron and Marianne Moline. And I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that they talked about Clancy a lot and that my grandpa had a really big funeral. And that was the extent of what I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous and PG. And I was pretty convinced that I was not an alcoholic. I thought that it was mostly homeless people and old men. While there are a lot of old men in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's many other different ages and types of people as well, I've learned. So my first meeting was ironically Pacific Group Wednesday night. And I just remember being completely overwhelmed by the number of people and also extremely creeped out by how much everyone was smiling. I thought it was a little culty. And I also just vividly remember relating to almost everything that was shared that night about the feeling that they had, describing that that spiritual malady. Now I know so much about it. At the time, I had never heard anyone talk about it. So it was comforting and also scary to, you know, see how much I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did stay. I kept going to meetings. I just did what everybody told me to do. I went to meetings, got a sponsor, started working the steps. And slowly but surely that first year, it was not sudden at all. By the end of the year, it was a pretty drastic shift. It was not sudden though. I gained a set of tools for living. I know that's said a lot here, but that was quite literally what happened. I became happier. I was less depressed. It was kind of like this fog had lifted. I was enjoying life, and life got really, really good, really fast for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Throughout my sobriety, it hasn't, always been great. I met my husband in the room. We got married. We had this great life. He ended up relapsing. You know, just something that we've learned, like even when life's amazing, it's never a time to take the foot off the pedal for Alcoholics Anonymous. We always have to stay grounded. And what we learned in that whole experience was really, we have to put our programs first. So today our programs, he's now sober again. We, you know, we both work very separate programs and keep it at the forefront of our marriage and our family. So it has to come first before everything. And at about 7 years sober, you know, at this point, like my husband had relapsed, we recovered from that. I thought that I had this like really great program. And my second sponsor let me go. And it was mostly because of distance. It was really hard to get together in person. But I was pretty upset about it. And I remember I had to start looking for a new sponsor. And like my immediate first thought was, I don't want to find another sponsor. I'm just going to stop going. but I did look for another sponsor. And I remember hearing Linda speak at or share at a Monday night meeting that we still go to. And I she just had this like sense of peace about her. And I remember telling my husband, I'm like, I'm going to ask her to be my sponsor. And he's like, don't ask her because she's going to make you go to Pacific Group. And I was like, no, she's not. I'm going to ask her anyway. But now here I am. But what I got out of my working with Linda was a really, really intense way of working the steps, we worked the steps out of the big book. And then also coming to PG, it's just a different level of sobriety, a different level of commitment. And more than anything, a very thorough third step and a fear inventory, which I had not worked before. I realized that at 7 years sober, I had been clinging to a lot of parts of my alcoholism that I didn't even know were alcoholism. So releasing those was excruciating. It was almost like getting sober again. But coming out on the other side, I do feel today that sense of peace, that sense of serenity, like really what I had been looking for my whole entire life, just everything that I had wanted. And today, life's really good. I have an amazing family. Still married to my amazing husband. We have a happy, sober home. I now have more time than him, which is also really fun. We have two kids and who I love and who I just, I cherish and I am very patient with them. I have an amazing job. Just basically everything that I have is a result of this program. And I'm very aware that I would not be enjoying any of these things. I would not be afforded the job with people that report to me, responsible for clients and revenue. When I was drinking, I was working at Hallmark and couldn't even show up to work, and I had the key to the store. So it's very crazy thinking about all the responsibilities that I have. And also the whole pandemic thing, it's just been, I know everybody's in the same boat, but it's been kind of like that next level of sobriety. I really miss going to in-person meetings. I never thought I would say that. I am grateful for Zoom, but it's just been definitely a shift, and an avenue to my higher power where, you know, that community, the people that we're so used to seeing in person, isn't there. So it's just, forced me even more for those outreach calls and to, foster that relationship with my higher power. I will say today, I do feel at peace. I feel like I have God with me all day, which I've never felt like, before when I was drinking. So I'm very, very grateful for my sobriety. And I miss all of you, but it's good seeing you. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Chelsea. Our second 10-minute speaker is John G.
My name is John Graff. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Marty for inviting me, although I didn't thank him when he called me. I asked if can I get in the showcase of singers to sing happy birthday? And, he promptly denied that request. I don't want to show up the talent with my silky smooth voice. I want to thank Chelsea for her 10 minutes. And I really want to thank Marty for doing a bang up job with this meeting and keeping the traditions and the standards going. It cannot be tough. If you're new, I don't succumb to the fact that I hear in a lot of meetings nowadays, I don't know how you're staying sober. I couldn't, don't believe that, because there's a power in this room that far surpasses anything that your fears can imagine. And if you follow the instructions, you can have a brand new life. You can, whether you want it or not, I was a little weird kid. All my brothers and sister were older than me. I have this older brother that hates me. I don't say that he hates me just because it's, trendy thing to say. I mean, he hates me. He's shot me. He's hung me. He stabbed me. And that's before I hit 10 years old. And so I have a way, actually. I don't even have to say anything to you, and I have to make amends. That's a gift, you know, that I just found out recently. He told me that I'm from the Midwest, and he told me that we went to the dump one day that I wasn't a graph, that they found me. My mom found me at the dump. I was about 4 or 5 when he told me this. And I don't know what your head's working like at 4 or 5, but I go to my mom in tears. And if love could have fixed me, love would have fixed me that day, because my mom did everything that a mother should do. She, you know, comforted me. She consoled me. She affirmed me that I was named after my uncle, my grandfather. I was planned, all of this stuff. Now, if love could have fixed me, it would have fixed me. But much like Chelsea talked about and alluded to, there's something off in me and my thinking. And I didn't need any explanation on that as a kid. And that's to this day. I have a 13-year-old son that has more on the ball going on with him right now at 13 than I do at, I'm going to be 60. He's constantly correcting me. For example, I was yelling at somebody the other day, and he asked me, he said, "Hey, can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." He said, "Has it ever occurred to you yelling at people really doesn't work? Like, have you ever?" I was like, "Shut up." You know, like, I don't know what that is. There's something broken in my thinking. Anyway, what happened was we went to my sister's wedding, and my brother said, "Go steal the punch bowl." And that's what it was. I didn't feel like I fit in that family. Like I said, they're all older. They found me at the dump, blah, 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 you know. And I was always this kid, and I still have it today, to where I always look, Norm Alpie used to talk about the grass was greener on the other side of the fence. And I learned in AA, the grass is greener on the other side of the fence because that guy waters his grass. But I always felt like I was missing something, like I was getting cheated out of something. And when I saw people drink, that's what I gravitated towards. That I, to me, that was part of being a man and growing up and, you know. So that's what I did. And I can remember my dad was still in my life at that time. And I was off to the races. I didn't care what my dad thought of him. By the time I was 26 years old, I was shot out. I had open sores all over my body. I had, I was about 110 pounds and I was yellowish green. And Alcoholics Anonymous started to work in my life without me wanting it to work in my life. My brother was sober, that one that hated me. He got me into this program. And that place, as my old sponsor used to say, taught me the best thing that I could ever say. Because I'm a Weisenheimer at best. I can always dispute or make excuses or not own up to. But in that thing, sitting in that stupid thing called group one day, I got my moment of identification. That's what my sponsor used to call, you know, one thing that an alcoholic always has. One alcoholic talking to another to feel his feelings of indifference so that he identifies. And that's what happened to that thing. And I hate a group. I hate a group. Anyway, I got out of there. I've done, I was in the Midwest. I was 3 years sober. I did everything that I thought Alcoholics Anonymous had to offer. And I wanted to eat a bullet. Much like Chelsea talked about where, you know, it was just life was grim. And I thought I had done everything that I knew about what is being taught about by a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I reached out to a lady named Karen Garrison, who turned me on to her sponsor. And she said that he would love to sponsor a jerk like me. And I can remember calling that man in the state that I described myself, and he knew exactly how I felt at 3 years sober. And came out here and started my life out here in Southern California in the Pacific Group. And I've been a part of this group for 28 years now. And, you know, action is the magic word until you have a pandemic, you know, and then, you know, it really kind of forced me back into the big book. It really kind of forced me back into the steps. You know, my life has significantly changed. My wife, my loving wife has been, you know, on the COVID ward to the ICU ward to, you know, back into the ER. And, you know, my son's, you know, a seventh grade and going through and doing his thing. And, you know, and I've started over in a business that I had no idea what it was. And, you know, and I can't talk about how good my life is once I get out of the way. I wasn't going to take this job. You know, I talked to Tim. Tim became my sponsor after Clancy passed away. And Tim said, you know what, John, just take the job and don't worry about it. Things will fall into place. And that, I don't know about you, but I know about me. I'm always got to sit and tweak with things and figuring them out and trying to, you know, never, as Chelsea alluded to, never having the faith to trust God and not go through that fear and write down my fears and give it to God and somebody else. You know, but staying dedicated to a, you know, to a routine, to a, like, if it's a, you know, it's a spiritual routine. That's what I've fell into, really. And I don't know about everybody else, but I kind of came to terms with this whole thing because the whole thing here is change. The whole thing here is change. And I don't know about you, but I don't like change. And just kind of folding into it and leaning into it, getting back into the book, into the steps, and going to the meetings that I can and showing up for my responsibilities. I've never had such a good life. I never have had such a good life. And if you're new, I can tell you this. If you will just trust somebody else's idea for your life, you can sit here one day and have that same expression, that same feeling that I'm just trying to describe to you. If you don't, you'll have the same shitty experience you've been having. So choice is yours. You know, we're not doing a fundraiser. We're not doing anything. We're just convinced of the fact that our life was a failure and we're offering you a solution to yours. Hope you can join. Thanks.
And speaker tonight is Adam T.
My name is Adam. I am an alcoholic. Everyone can hear me. Want to thank the group for inviting me to come talk tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Welcome to anybody that's new. And if you're trying AA again, if you don't want to be here tonight, if you don't think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you, I didn't get to AA because I had a bad weekend. You know, I had a couple of bad decades. And for me, like a lot of us, eventually this becomes a matter of life and death. I mean, every meeting has their perpetual newcomer, especially in a smaller community. We see that lost soul recycling through the rooms. And I, you know, I stood up for 17 years. I was a teenager when I first started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had so many chips and key tags. Like a lot of us, we know the drill. I could have played poker with them. I remember one secretary saying, give them back. You know, and I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And looking back at that experience now, I thank God for the unconditional love of the old timers. A lot of the old timers that are in the group that said stuff to me like, you know what? Don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back. Shut up. You know, but in a loving way, right? But they made it really clear to me. And if you're new, I hope you hear this. Those old timers made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, Because they could see it by my demeanor, my lack of interest, my fidgety nature. They could see that it wasn't right now. But those old timers made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous would always be open to a drunk like me. And I think really looking back at that experience now, next to my parents, Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the closest thing to unconditional love that a drunk like me will ever experience. No matter how many lives I destroyed, how many hearts I broke, how many jobs I lost, how many cars I wrecked, how many despicable, shameful things I did. And if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, it's the most shameful thing in the world to be the family drunk, especially if you come from a large family. Like I have family on, you know, three continents. And, you know, to watch those people, literally, I mean, you know, one more jail cell, one more rubber room, one more 5150, happy birthday, Dad, I'm in jail. I mean, if you really look at the high price we pay for this low quality of life, you know, to eventually watch my mom, who literally sold the family property, moved, and didn't leave a forwarding address when I was in an institution. That's where I left that relationship. And all of these years later, I look at parents. You see this procession of parents outside these elementary schools, you know, moms and dads waiting for their kids. And to watch those two people literally watch me burn my life to the ground, absolutely awful. And despite all of that, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous has always been open to people like me. If I lived to be 100 years old, I could never pay AA back for the love and kindness that, you know, what some of you people have shown me, not all. And my sponsor said, you know, if you like everybody in AA, you know what it means? It means you're probably not going to enough meetings. He told me I didn't have to like anybody in particular, but I had to need to learn to love everyone in general. And what happened to me eventually, I know no one ever sees this anymore, but eventually I started coming to meetings drunk. And what I would do is I would go to 7-Eleven. I would get a big gulp cup. I would fill it up with liquor. I'd put a little Coca-Cola on top so no one would notice. And I would stroll into the late night Hollywood candlelight meeting, you know, do some of my best sharing. And then I started appearing in treatment centers. And it's kind of funny because by the time I finally got sober, I'd gone through residential treatment for alcoholism 28 times, not 28 days like the movie. 28 consecutive times. And I started to wear like that, like a badge of honor. It almost became my identity. And I remember telling my sponsor I'd gone through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would get rid of the guy. You know, he was one of those overzealous sponsors. And he looks at me and he starts laughing and he says, you know, going through treatment 28 times, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, oh no, that just means you paid $500,000 for a big book. And I didn't think that was funny. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book. But page 101 of the big book says, any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run. Treatment has its rightful place in recovery. Even Bill Wilson had gone through treatment. Treatment may have saved my life. Some people don't go through treatment. In fact, you know what all the treatment centers really have in common is they all send their drunks to us. But if you're new tonight, treatment never solved the problem. And as an alcoholic, like so many of us, I always thought the problem was liquor. I thought it was alcohol. And I remember someone in AA saying to me, Adam, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, that little fancy glass of Chardonnay, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then he paused, and in the very next breath, he said to me, and if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem is an alcohol. And he paused, and it took me another decade. It took me 10 more years to understand the impact of that statement. It was almost like some kind of cruel riddle. I drank over that for years. But what happened to me, and we use the word serendipity, what happened to me is I got around a group of big book enthusiasts, people in Alcoholics Anonymous that took the statements in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, turned the statements into questions, and directed those questions at me. Questions like, was I incapable of being honest with myself? Did I, in fact, drink because I liked the effect produced by alcohol? Was I restless, irritable, and discontent by nature? Was that my natural state? Was my greatest obsession that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy my drinking at the same time? And did I pursue that illusion, meaning just out of reach, to the gates of insanity and death? And as I started to go through those considerations, for the first time, I saw the truth. And the most obvious truth, the external unmanageability of alcoholism, was that I was never able to live successfully with alcohol. Even as a teenager, I was already peeing in my pants, drooling on my desk, passed out under the bleachers. I always overshot the mark. My nickname in eighth grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. People were picking high schools. I was already picking rehabs. But if you're new tonight, alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or six packs or 12 packs or kegs or little glasses of wine. Alcoholism comes in people. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson describes it, centering in my mind, if going through those considerations in the book shows me anything at all, it shows me that an alcoholic of my type, an alcoholic of this type, cannot live without alcohol, not successfully, not happily. And part of what it seems to mean for me to be an alcoholic, if I'm honest about my relationship with liquor, is that I seem to have a mind that will consistently take me back to alcohol. Every time I get released from a treatment center, an emergency room, a hospital, men's central jail, 5743, roll it up. It's fascinating. As soon as I hear my release number, it doesn't matter how long I've been locked up in that cage, as soon as I hear that release number, I have this visceral compulsion to drink. I don't even stop for my property. And if anybody relates to that idea, that all of my life I discovered that I was one decision away from a drink. One decision. And if you're new here tonight, between me and that decision now, there is a whole world called recovery. It's about people like you. It's about the rooms of AA. It's about this way of life. It's about a design for living. It's about this fellowship. For some of us, it's about this mystery we call God. And for me in particular, it seems to be about a deep and effective spiritual experience, something that stands between me and that decision. And it never really occurred to me until much later in my recovery that what it really meant to be an alcoholic, this thing we talk about called powerlessness. It's part of the book where it says that someone like me will pass through the state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. It says my willpower becomes virtually non-existent. So what it really means after all those institutions, with a college degree no less, is that I have a mind that will continue to take me back to alcohol. It's almost like my default program, like on a computer. And I've had the privilege, now we call the West Side Silicon Beach, right? I've had the privilege of sponsoring a lot of really smart guys that write code. I mean, I had calculus in high school. I was a math major for a while. And, you know, I sponsor guys that write programs. And we talk about the language that Bill Wilson uses in 1939 and how really advanced it was for that time period. Because today we use the word program all the time. One of the definitions of the word program is very simple. What it means is a sequential set of instructions that brings about a result. Now listen to the language. What do you do when you get a corrupt file on a computer? Well, it's obvious. You install a recovery disk. And the function of that disk is to restore that program, just like the second step, to an earlier point in the process. It never occurred to me that steps 10 and 11 effectively become like a viral scan. They become operative in a way for me to actually be mindful of where I paint the red flags green, where I'm driven by resentment, the delusion that I live in, and to be rid of it promptly without reservation, to bookend my day with an upon awakening prayer. And once I started to understand that, it became much more powerful than just the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It never occurred to me when Wilson says principles before personalities, it was the founder's future hope that these spiritual instructions would have more impact than sometimes, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the hysterical opinions that we hear in the fellowship. And I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been my experience that if alcohol is the problem, the solution is abstinence. And all AA is the Sober Elks Club. But if it really is what Bill Wilson says it is, this spiritual malady, this distortion in my perception of reality, then really the fellowship is not enough. It even says it in the second chapter. It says it's but one element in the powerful cement that binds us. It gives me enthusiasm. The fellowship gives me inspiration. It gives me encouragement. It gives me hope, brotherly love, right? Some people actually find relationships and employment here. But my experience now is if you unleash someone like me into a large group of people without guiding principles, my character defects thrive in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And somehow what happens is I get sicker in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous without guiding principles. And what that looks like for me is somehow I become more separate, more different, and more alone. And if you haven't heard that terminology, what it really means is separated from God. Different than every single person here. That's what we call terminal uniqueness, if you haven't heard that term. And alone, you know, that loneliness, that ache in the heart of every one of us that really has nothing to do with the proximity or closeness of other people. The bigger the crowd, the more alone I feel. What that really is for me is my inability to connect with others. And you put a couple of drinks in me, I'm calling people from fifth grade saying, I love you. I go right into amends, put a couple of drinks in me, and all of a sudden I'm at one with the universe. I'm standing on the roof of my building howling at the moon. Put a couple more drinks in me, I'm okay with me. Get me good and drunk, I lose interest in selfish things and suddenly gain interest in my fellows. It's absolutely astonishing to me how I turn from selfishness and self-centeredness to other-centeredness just by having a couple drinks. And my experience shows me that unless I can develop that sense of comfort and ease that I always sought from alcohol through this process, a drunk like me will never stay here. You take booze away from me, you don't give me something better, I will always have that sense of inadequacy. I will always feel like I'm on the outside looking in. And our dear friend Clancy used to say, safe, sane, and sober. And what I've come to understand is parallel to being separate, different, and alone, there is a world of recovery that for me has three fundamental ideas. The first one is to be protected by some kind of God. And you hear it in every meeting, that sense of safety. I ask for his care and protection with complete abandon. It's like if you abandon a ship, you can't get back on it. I go to the ocean with a little cup, I get a cup full of water. I go to the ocean with my whole life. I say, God, take all of me, take my relationship, take my career, take my fear, take my selfishness. That relationship looks very, very different. There's a prayer which is very much in line with the seven-step prayer, and it says, God, thank you for everything you've given me. Thank you for everything you've taken from me. But most of all, thank you for what you've left me. And that first piece, what remains in that concession is love, is relationships, is integrity. The second piece, to be accepted by self. And what I never understood is what that meant was I would no longer need internal or external validation. Over a long period of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially in steps 4 through 7, is I would develop what we call an internal locus of control. It's a therapeutic concept, but the third piece is to be connected to a community. And that's where suddenly the fellowship becomes empowerment. To be protected by God, accepted by self, and connected with community. And all of a sudden, I go from being the weakest link in my family. And I'm talking about generations of suicide, mental illness, and alcoholism. To 22 and a half years later, the strongest link in that family. That's why we say the disease of alcoholism is the only disease, when treated, that actually leaves the sufferer in a better position than if I never had the disease. And if you're new, I would have never believed that. I challenge that idea to the gates of insanity and death. And what I've discovered, and a lot of us talk about, the view from the center of AA, the perspective from the middle is very different than it is from the outside. I can fall off the edge. I can't fall off the middle. And I was asked in this group to be very, very centered, to have commitments, to come early, to stay late, to congratulate the birthdays, to congratulate the CHIP people, and all the things that aren't specifically in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous became actions that I was willing to take that I did not yet believe in. And over a period of time, those actions brought about a change in my perception of reality. And I didn't understand it. Like I said, I'd stood up for almost 17 years. I was in this group. John F. was my first sponsor in the late 80s. Then Ron Acosta, who also is gone, he was one of my sponsors. And I had stood up for almost 17 years. My mom had known Clancy in the late 80s. And when I look back at my failure in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I see is my defiance towards spiritual principles. And it's so funny because the original manuscript of AA, I was just at a conference out of town, and they read the original manuscript of Chapter 5. And what it says is, rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our directions. And if you're like me, I hate directions. I don't like being told not to do something I already don't want to do, right? I mean, it is my nature to be defiant. It dogs my every step. And what that looks like is, I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. That's why we say denial's an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You can tell an alcoholic, you can't tell them much. You don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. And what that really means is, you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. And when Wilson talks about attraction rather than promotion in that 11th tradition, what I eventually came to understand as an alcoholic, after all those institutions, is I would eventually come back to AA on my own terms. Not because sober living wanted me to, not because the parole office wanted me to, not because DCSF thought it was a good idea. I mean, the guys I sponsor now, they only come to AA to keep their trust fund. But my experience, if you're new, is hope doesn't matter to a drunk like me until I'm hopeless. Do you think hope matters to me when I got $500,000 left in the bank, new Harley in the driveway, little truck, boat down in the marina? I bet all that stuff. You wouldn't catch me dead in an AA meeting. Now, my experience, if you're new, is God didn't matter to me until my back was against the wall. And I'm not, you know, this isn't gutter bravado, but I remember I got shot in a little argument. I'm laying on this gurney. The bullet went right through the center of my back. And I'm looking up at these paramedics, and I'm still conscious. And, you know, they get the little paddles over me. And I remember, all I know is God. When I was on my deathbed, or I thought I was, it's so interesting because, you know, when you're in a situation where you're facing your mortality, if anyone's ever experienced that, there's only two things people ask for: mommy and God. I mean, if you're a drunk like me and you got your head in that toilet every morning puking your guts out, I mean, come on, who prays more than people like us? If you don't relate, maybe Al-Anon would be an interesting place for you. But see, what's so fascinating, and I'm not putting down Al-Anon, I love Al-Anon, but the fact is I go from that place where I'm facing alcoholic destruction, and 3 days later, you got to write this elaborate chapter called We Agnostics to try to prove and establish to me there just might be a power other than me. The arrogance that stands between me and any kind of spiritual experience is absolutely astonishing. I have a coin that was given to me by someone in AA, and it says, the greatest battle in a man or a woman's life is not against their brother or sister, it is against themselves. And for the first time, I understood. See, the longest trip for an alcoholic is from my head to my heart. The shortest trip was from my knees to the ground. And it's so fascinating because Bill Wilson uses the word cornered in his story, where he realizes he can't live with it. And he can't live without it. And Harry Tebow, who's in the third appendices of the Big Book, and he's a friend of Bill Wilson's and Alcoholics Anonymous and a board certified psychiatrist. Harry Tebow says the four qualities of an alcoholic are grandiose, sensitive, immature, and omnipotent. And those are our finer qualities. I tell people, stick that in your next Tinder ad, right? Right next to selfish, dishonest, resentful, and afraid, right? And I start to see what it is that's blocking me. And if you're new, thank God we don't look like our stories, right? Because so what happened to me is I get to one more treatment center. I'm 120 pounds. I stink like urine. My fingers are dirty. You know, a lot of us come to AA. I mean, everyone looks so good tonight. But the way I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I look like a concentration camp victim. That's what I look like when I walk into AA every single time. You know, and I'm sitting in my nightgown in treatment with my ass hanging out, judging the speaker. It's so funny because we're the only people that could actually be on the curb and still look down at the world, right? I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. and I'm strutting around this detox bragging about robbing Brinks trucks. I finally did my four step. It was a bread truck and it was empty. So I'm sitting in this treatment center and this woman comes in on an AA panel and she does her H&I talk. If you're not aware, H&I stands for hospitals and institutions. It's a committee that brings meetings into prisons, detoxes, treatment centers. And this woman is on this H&I panel and she does her AA talk. And at the end of her talk, she looks us all up and down and she says, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And she paused. And I remember looking at her and I looked at the guy next to me and it was like yesterday. I misunderstood what she said. And I said, what a bitch. And what she said after that, she paused and she said, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery, the reason I wouldn't give it to you is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And if you're new all these years later, I've come to understand that that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender that each and every alcoholic has to walk, is personal. If you're new, we can't give you that gift of desperation. I've had the privilege of working with a lot of younger people. And I tell them, if you're in a hot tub with a supermodel, a fifth of whiskey and an eight ball, and your dad sends you to rehab, we don't expect you to be happy. I mean, I was 17 years old in AA. And that was like, I mean, that was 40 years ago. And the old timers would say stuff like, you know what, kid, we spilled more than you drank. And we're like, you know what, pops, we didn't spill any. That's why we got here sooner. But all these years later, I understand that gift of desperation very, very differently. And that gift of desperation now, I could write all day long on step one until I'd beaten down that liquor store door at 5:59 a.m. over and over and over again, or paid the clerk at 7-Eleven $100 for a six-pack, or driven all the way to Tijuana to get at the bars after closing, or done all those despicable, disgusting, diabolical things that many of us do on that journey to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You think writing about step one was going to somehow save me or enhance my understanding? I had to have a relationship with alcohol. I had to see how self-will failed me. And eventually I got to a place like a lot of us where my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take any more. And that's the kind of drinking you see down on Skid Row. And you know what? I became a low bottom drunk. And I understand now that I have to have compassion for that person every single day in Alcoholics Anonymous. When my head can't get enough and my body can't take any more, God means something totally different. It means grow or die. Then I'm suddenly confronted with two choices. And we hear about it in every meeting, right? Go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. The other is to accept spiritual help. It's so funny because it doesn't say stop drinking. It doesn't say face with alcoholic destruction or stop drinking. It says face with alcohol destruction or to live on a spiritual basis. It says these are not easy choices. Very interesting because, I mean, if you do a survey at Costco, you got jails, institutions, and death, happy, joyous, and free. It's a no-brainer. You step over to my cell in Men's Central Jail and you confront me with that question, and I'm scratching my head thinking, how bad an alcoholic death? Can I talk to my parole officer, my counselor, my yoga teacher, my MFT, and get back to you on Monday? And it's so fascinating. I will justify, minimize, and rationalize that first thing. Absolutely awful. There is a saying, God cannot use a man till he comes to the end of himself. And I don't want to be divisive. I'm filling up my car with gas and I'm driving up to Malibu to speak at one more treatment center. And as soon as I walk in the door, the first thing I hear is, oh no, not sushi again. And I'm trying to think, how am I going to establish some kind of gratitude with people that are so entitled, that are so spoiled, that they're concerned more with the fact that they're being forced to eat steak and roast beef and sushi one more time in rehab? And I start to see, what is it that's blocking me? And what I've discovered is that from Yale to jail, Park Avenue to Park Bench, the bottom for an alcoholic is the same. And what it really is when I ask for help and I'm actually willing to receive it. I was so entitled as a young man. I had everything that life had to offer. And until my mom literally moved and didn't leave a forwarding address, until I was stripped of my inheritance and everything that would sustain me, I could not take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't believe in. And what I've discovered now is it's very simple. It's almost like it's when I ask for help and I'm willing to receive it. It's like throwing a new guy a life raft and he looks at the life raft and he says, you know, I'm looking for a blue one. I really don't like the way you threw it. How do I work with someone like that? And I would defend my right to drink. And what's so crazy about that, if you're new, is the rest of my life after I stopped drinking, I would defend my right to play God. And everything that book talks about, me trying to force satisfaction out of the world if I can only manage well. And it's so interesting because, you know, going through therapeutic communities over and over, going through treatment 28 times, I started to speak a foreign language in treatment. You guys know what it is, right? It's called victimese. And the way that looks for me is I don't understand how the drink bone connects to the jail bone, right? It's like I need a class for that, relapse prevention. It's kind of like I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. Sound familiar? I knew he was a crackhead. Can't believe he stole my iPhone. And what's happening is I stop drinking, and all of a sudden, these manifestations of self start to drive me back to that drink. And what the book says is I make decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. And until I could reconcile that, the difference between the way I thought things ought to be and the way they actually were, I knew no freedom. That's why we say in AA, surrender or be dragged. And until I understood that as an alcoholic, I couldn't get free of this. My sponsor stood in front of me outside that treatment center, and he said, how free do you want to be? You want to be free enough to survive alcoholism? Or do you want to be free enough to chase your dreams? Free enough to have relationships that work? Free enough to navigate around the drama? Free enough to match calamity with serenity? And he presented a picture of recovery that was much different than abstinence. And if you're new, my experience is fear wouldn't keep me sober. It was not enough. Bill Wilson said fear sobered him up for a bit, but that was insufficient. Getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, losing my career, throwing away my education. Did scared straight work for you? It went right over my head. Now, the big book talks about the problem drinker. We've all heard this. Big difference between a problem drinker and a real alcoholic. Think about it. You get a problem drinker and a real alcoholic in a drunk tank for drunk driving. You got two completely different philosophies going on. You got the problem drinker on one side of the cell thinking, why did I drink so much last night? I knew I shouldn't have drank so much. Why didn't I take Uber? Real alcoholics on the other side of the cell thinking, why did I take the 405? Now, the court card people never laugh at that, right? Problem drinker's wife says, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you. Problem drinker cleans up his act, doesn't drink in the house, gets a little Visine. If my woman says to me, if you don't stop drinking, honey, I'm leaving you. You know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. And my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous was exactly the same. If anything got in the way of drinking, it was out of my life. And my experience now with AA, in order for me to stay in recovery, if anything gets in the way of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's out of my life. A relationship, a career, all of that, what I've discovered, has to be compatible with Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor guys that pay more in taxes than I earn all year. They have these huge careers, these little tiny programs. I've never seen one of them stand the test of time. I was asked, what do I do for a living? I stay sober. What do I do for money? That's over there. If I get those two things mixed up, I'm back in handcuffs. I get those two things mixed up, I'm back in an emergency room. Or I get a double header. I'm handcuffed to a gurney in an emergency room. But if you're new, my experience has continued to show me puke smells the same in a Mercedes. That I can chase money, property, and prestige. But what Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do was to chase a spiritual life. And the suggestion was, if I chased a spiritual life, money, property, and prestige would chase me. And that was completely and absolutely counterintuitive. It was never something that occurred to me. Just like Bill Wilson was a materialist, and he had to relinquish that and be driven by this thing called altruism in order for this to work for him. And I never understood that. If the real problem is selfishness and self-centeredness, the solution has to be God-centeredness. It has to be service-centeredness. And in the spiritual community, there's a thing called chop wood, carry water. And I used to think, what the heck does that mean? And what it means, if you live in a cold climate, if you don't chop wood every night, you freeze to death. If you don't carry water up from that river every day, you die. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I look at my failure in AA, what I start to see is these three fundamental ideas. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, get a job. Work steps, help others. Go to meetings, get a job, maybe get married, help others. But see, part of the word spiritual is ritual. And when we talk about mind, body, and spirit, it's parallel with those three ideas. Go to meetings, work steps, maybe bury a parent, help others. But those ideas, like that triangle, recovery, unity, and service, from my experience now, they translate into three actions. Contribute, belong, and learn. Contributing is service. The more that I do it, the more my spirit feels needed. Belonging is unity. The more that I show up for meetings and I follow these 12 traditions, the more that I feel wanted. And the base of that triangle, the more I uncover, discover, and discard that which is blocking me from God, from self, and from others, the more that I can give and receive love. It's almost like the steps bring me wisdom, the fellowship where two or more are gathered bring me power. And by reaching back in my community and being of service for the first time in my life, I can give and receive love. Very, very simplistic ideas. Very much like cognitive behavioral therapy. It's like a, you know, it's an expensive endeavor. In AA, it's one sentence. I can't think my way into right living, but I can live my way into right thinking. Very, very simple idea. So one of the things that happened to me when I got out of that 28th treatment center is the guy that was running the detox said to me, why don't you come back to our lovely detox next week and tell all the patients here how you managed to stay sober a whole week, if you can make it. And he dismissed me like, you know, like I didn't matter. And I got a big resentment against this guy. And for the next 8.5 years, I sat in bumper to bumper traffic from South LA County to the West Valley to tell a bunch of strangers at a detox that didn't care how I stayed sober another week. And what happened is I was tricked into service. That one minute?
Yes, 1 minute.
Okay. So, in closing, if someone did to me what I did to myself, I would have killed them. If someone did to me what I did to others, I would have killed them. And then I come to AA and you want me to pray to God. I didn't want God to find out where I was. I was bankrupt in those very simple relationships. If you're new, what I never understood is the 12 steps were designed to remedy those three relationships. Steps 1 through 3, recreated and developed a relationship with God. 4 through 7, recreate and develop a relationship with self. 8 and 9, recreate and develop a relationship with others. It's a very simple idea. 10, maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with self. 11, maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with God. 12, through service, maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps, a selfish, self-centered drunk like me is not only easily able to control my desire for alcohol, that's right out of the doctor's opinion, but for the first time, I'm able to live in harmony with God, self, and others. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? He said, love God with all thy heart, love thy neighbor as thyself. And as many people have said, if God scares you out of AA and you're a real drunk, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you back in. So in 1 through 3, I give it up. 4 through 7, I clean it up. 8 and 9, I make it up. 10, 11, and 12, I keep it up. And that simple idea has brought me, like a lot of us, to a place where now I have a purpose, I have a power, and I have a program in my life. And you know what? That's impossible. All the therapy, all the psychiatry, all the medication, none of that could have brought me to a place where, you know, a drunk like me has a little self-respect and actually a way to help others. It's a big deal. Thank you very much for having me tonight.
AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything that would affect you from the neck up. If you're a regular attender of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
And please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you have to wait until the following week to get recognized. This week, we have a special guest sing us a birthday song to our celebrants.
Hi, my name is Hannah, alcoholic. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. Keep zooming back.
Thank you, Hannah. Our birthdays this week are, look at that. That's cute. We have Roger T for 8 years. His sponsor is Thomas S. We have Andrea B for 12 years. Her sponsor is Sia F. We have Larry B for 14 years. Sponsor is Jerry J. We have Frank R for 17 years. Sponsor is Robert K. We have John C for 20 years. His sponsor is Steve W. We have James M for 36 years. His sponsor is Tom B. We have Jonathan S for 48 years. His sponsor is Tom B. So we had a total of 7 birthdays for 155 years, average being 21.14 per cake. Happy birthday to the celebrants. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org. Underneath